Tonight, the case of the American Indian, his past and his future, will be spotlighted through open discussion and in questioning of our guest, Dr. Theodore Hetzel, of the faculty of Haverford College. Now here is Joe Brush to introduce our topic and our guest.
Good evening. The plight of the American Indian, his past, his present, and his future, makes headline news from time to time. The question of government responsibility regarding the American Indian and the work of the Bureau of Indian Affairs leads my colleague, Margaret Mary Kearney, and I to ask our guest a very direct question. Dr. Hetzel, just what is the Indian problem, as you see it?
It's a human relations problem. It's an economic problem. It's a social problem. It's all kinds of human problems rolled up into one. Someplace in the line, in the circle, we have to find where to make a better start, and I guess it's on education. So we might say that education is one of the key aspects of the problem.
Dr. Hetzel, just how many Indians are there in the United States, and where do they live?
There are just about 500,000 Indians in the United States and in Alaska. About 50% of them live in the Southwest, including California. Most of them, of course, beyond the Mississippi River. Just a few in Maine, a few somewhat more in Florida, a few in the Carolinas, but practically all are in the far west, the north, and about 25% of them in Oklahoma. It's rather hard to count the ones in Oklahoma because they're so admixed with the rest of the population that it's hard to define just what an Indian is. But about 500,000 Indians, and most in the Southwest.
Well, Doctor, last week on this program, we were talking about especially cities and moving into areas by groups who stayed very closely together. I imagine this could be expanded to include the American Indian, too. They do live in tribes still, very closely knit in single groups, don't they?
On their reservations. But in the cities, I don't think of them as living together in the same localities, except that in Brooklyn, there is a small island of Mohawk Indians who work in the steel construction industry, living like white people, but they are Indians, and they go home sometimes to their reservation and their relatives. And then in Chicago, there are large numbers of Indians who are centered not tribally, that is to say, Indians from all tribes are in much the same area around the University of Chicago, and then somewhat north of the Loop, and then somewhat west of the Loop. There are quite a number, but they're living in a neighborhood rather than in solid close blocks.
But what I meant was that they are on the reservation together. They don't intermarry with different tribes. How many full-blooded Indians do we have today?
There's a great deal of intermarriage. And how many are full-blood varies from 0 to 100%. Among the Navajo, it would be very largely full-bloods. Among the Papago, it's very largely full-bloods. Other tribes, maybe some of the Sioux tribes might be 50%. And others to a lesser extent.
Well, the Indians who live in metropolitan areas have a very high standard then of living. What is the standard of living?
I would question that.
Oh, would you really?
Very definitely.
Oh?
Now, there is a program. Indians have been going to the city from the very start, of course, those that wish to and those who are able to. Recently, the Bureau has been operating an assistance program called the Relocation Program, which is very helpful to those Indians who wish to move to the city. They pay transportation one way and provide social services and help them get a job and a place to live and give them very great help, the family as well as the worker, in getting established. But many of these people really aren't ready for this great experience, this great change from the reservation. And many of them return home. In fact, I think I must say that most of them return home. But those who wish to stay in the cities, it's a very great assistance to them. They get jobs in all sorts of things, mostly as laborers. Most of them are not prepared for skills of a higher level.
This is difficult to understand, though, at this day and in this day and age, that you feel that they are not prepared. Of course, this goes back to your original statement that you think much has to be done on the educational level. Mm-hmm. Let's take the Indians who live in a metropolitan area, though. Their children will go to the schools in that area.
Mm-hmm.
And do you feel that from among these groups, at least, they're being developed any young professional people of note among the Indians of today?
Well, I hope so, but of course the people we're talking about in education would be the very young ones. Very few Indians have gone on with their education.
Well, what's the
answer? I can make an example of in Minnesota. There were about within this decade there were 1,600 Indians of college age, and there were 92 Indians in college. But of those Indians, 85 were from Asia. Asian Indians, not American Indians, just 8 out of 1,600 Indians of Indian age were in college in Minnesota. In recent years, the number in college has increased by several 100%. A very heartening increase.
Are they good students?
They're intelligent as anybody is. But as to being good students, I'm afraid I'd have to say no. They're not well enough prepared usually. Usually they don't have enough money. They often don't have the right clothes. They haven't been prepared for the social contact. They haven't learned the study habits that they would get in good schools. Many times they don't even, I'm sorry to say, have the incentive given them from home life to do well. Indians want to get married young, and the ideals that they have had that they wish to fulfill are not in the scholarly line particularly. So that rather few Indians are making a go of it. Now, I must say, this year, the Navajo tribe, for the first time, maintained a orientation program for students about to go to college at the Arizona State College in Tempe. They had a summer school just to get people ready for college so that they could learn to read faster and do college work and know how to get along and not flunk out too soon.
Well, I gather from what you've said, then, that the Indians who move to the city are not ready for city life. This is, then, a throwback to a somewhat cloistered life on the reservation, but doesn't necessarily mean that it's an educational problem. It sounds as though you mean a little more than that.
Those Indians who have served in the Army have had a good preparation for life among white people, and they're much more likely to make a go of it if they want to move off the reservation. Now, moving off the reservation is not an ideal that most Indians aspire to or value highly, but they're simply forced off because the Indian population is increasing so rapidly, although it's not the vanishing race anymore that people used to talk about. And there just isn't room on these restricted reservations for all these people to find a means of support. And the excess simply must move off, and they are being helped, as I said, by the relocation program to find opportunities in cities. Now, there has not been a real program of preparing these people, except, as I say, the experience in the armed services, so that many of them, particularly the wives and family, are just not ready for it.
How much federal money is allocated for the service to the Indian?
I couldn't say as for the relocation program, but if you mean the total...
I mean the total overall, yes.
For the Bureau of Indian Affairs, I think it is about $100 million a year. And then there is, in addition, a considerable amount of money spent by the U.S. Public Health Service for the health services to Indians, over which they have supervision.
Well, this tremendous amount of money that's allocated by the government, doesn't that take into consideration or plan in the course of this money and the allocation the actual education of the Indian on his life in the reservation? Now, why is the standard then of education so low? Because this is one of the things that's definitely thought of in planning for this money and this help, isn't it?
Some of this money does go into the education in the federal Indian schools.
I don't understand then why the standard of education is so low that they have difficulty getting into college and maintaining their marks along with other students. Do you understand that, Joe? Exactly. This is confusing to me.
Well, I would like to maybe clarify for our listeners just what life is like on the reservation first, and maybe we can pinpoint the reasons.
Yes. Well, just go back a ways. The Indians had all the land and were living in a stable situation when white people arrived and started pushing them back. They were pushed back into smaller and smaller territories that were too small to support them in the kind of economy that they were used to. Only the poor land was left to them. As Will Rogers said, the treaty said that we might have this land as long as the water's stream should flow and the grass should grow, but they gave us land on which no water flows and no grass grows, so they couldn't support themselves on the land that was left to them. And in addition, as I said, the numbers have increased so that the economic opportunities are not sufficient for a proper standard of living. Their old way of life being lost to them and being poor and having different cultural values too, I should say, they have not generally developed the ability to make a go in the white man's world. They are not competitive. They are not savers. They don't believe in saving money. They've lived in a hunting economy, and it is not good social relationships to be rich. A rich man is a pariah. He is a man who is unsocial. He hasn't shared everything that he had with everybody. So that given the Indian cultural practices and values, and the economic base on which they lived, they haven't been able to maintain a standard of living such as we think is necessary.
Do you think maybe too much is being done for them? Do you think the Indian would be better without government supervision?
Some do and some don't.
How do you feel?
Let me say what I think the Indian feels. The Indians who want to get rid of federal supervision are the improvident, the shiftless Indians who would like to sell out now, and any amount of money that they can get for their birthright is all to the good. The competent, able, businesslike, able Indian is all for the continuation of the governmental supervision. He sees the advantage that accrues to him by having tax-free land and special services of technical services for soil conservation and instruction in cattle ranching or whatever the activities of that community are, and the public health services that come to him are preferentially beneficial. Some of these things other citizens do not receive. I might say, though, that there is a general misapprehension that Indians get handouts or rations or special benefits that come to them because they are Indians. That was only true in the early days when they were captives and had to be fed. Indians are not fed or given any special rations or special handouts that that other people do not get as regular welfare payments, as white people would get the same.
Well, might not this so-called government trusteeship arrangement prevent the Indians from developing their own abilities to sort of pull themselves up?
It certainly can do that. What we call paternalism. Now, I'm a father, and I think that paternalism ought not be a bad word, but it is. The relationships of a parent to the child can make for immaturity in the child, or may prevent the child from growing up. But that isn't the proper role of the father, certainly. And I think that the improved or better role of the federal government would be such as to develop the maturity and the competence and the ability of Indians, rather than doing things for them so that they are not able to take care of themselves. In present Indian relationships with the Bureau, there is too much planning done for them. The Bureau decides what should be done and goes ahead and does it. Now, they claim to consult the Indians, but I'm sorry to say that in all too many instances, the consultation is rather a sham. They may tell the Indians what they're going to do and may try to sell the program, but it is scarcely adequate.
Are there any members of the Indian tribes of their own councils, I mean, they are autonomous, each of these groups, who serve as consultants with any people from the Bureau regarding the plan that the Bureau has for them?
No, I think the Bureau doesn't believe in asking consultants. They consult with the tribal officials, of course. However, they don't necessarily take what they have to say, to be sure. The Bureau of Indian Affairs is set up with the responsibility to Congress to render certain services to the Indians. Now, I say that's a very distinct step better than having the Indians run by the Army, as it was in the earlier days. For about a century, the policy was to defeat and control the Indians. And now the policy is to do things for the Indians. Someday, hopefully, there will be a policy to do things with the Indians and draw the Indians into the planning stages and give them responsibility and give them an opportunity to help participate in the execution of the programs. Then they'll grow up, and then they won't want federal services, and then they'll be off the taxpayers' back, and they'll be self-respecting free individuals. Now, people are all too prone to say, why don't we let the Indians be free and be full-fledged American citizens with all the rights and privileges there, too? Well, what they really mean is, let's quit giving them special services that are costing us money. Let's take away the tax-free preferential status of their lands. Let's just get rid of the problem. Let's get rid of them. Then there would be social problems of a very serious nature, because they are not yet at a point where they know how to take care of themselves.
You talk about their privileges as citizens. Do they take their citizenship seriously? Does the Indian take, for instance, the opportunity to vote in state and national government seriously? Or is he completely unaware of his obligation?
Well, that makes me say that it's all too easy to talk about Indians as though they were a general characteristic of Indians, and we must and we do, but Indian tribes differ so much from each other that one must be careful to say what the Indians are like or what they want, because there are all sorts of differences. And just the same, within a tribe, there are lots of individuals. So as far as their citizenship responsibility, Some certainly do, and some certainly don't. Now, some of the states have made it difficult for Indians in the past. They don't favor getting them registered, for instance. Many Indians live very dispersed out in the desert of Arizona, say, the Papago Indians, and the Navajo particularly, so that it's difficult for them to get to the polling places or the registration places, and the polling places don't come to them.
Do they have any desire to go? Do they have any desire to participate in government?
Increasingly recently, but not to a very large extent. Now, it would vary. Some Indian reservations that are nearer cities, many of the people would vote. Whereas for the Navajo, as I say, it's very difficult for them to get to the voting place. There's some question as to whether Indians in Arizona will be permitted to vote. But they are certainly citizens of the United States, and they have the privilege of voting.
Well, are you referring to voting within the state or voting in the federal government?
Well, of course, the elections are all set up by the states, even though it may be a federal election. The federal government does not make provisions for polling places, and so it must be dependent on state action to provide the facilities, the polling places, and the registration for the voters.
Would they make any effort if they live away from the metropolitan area, where the voting, shall we say, or a particular area where the voting is taking place? Will they make any effort to go and cast their vote?
I know very well some do. Mm-hmm. And some of their leaders have provided transportation so that people can get to the place to get registered.
Then there are among them leaders who do feel the sense of responsibility and who want to motivate their own people to participate.
Definitely, yes. Yes, increasingly.
Well, Doctor, we were talking about, basically, the Bureau of Indian Affairs. Are there any other branches of government that take an active interest in the Indian?
As I mentioned, the U.S. Public Health Service, and of course the armed services, they're very much interested in Indian men. They make good soldiers. And it's
do they make good soldiers?
Oh, yes, that's without question. Mm-hmm. It may be interesting for many people to know that the Navajo language and some other Indian languages have been used as open codes in the point of battle where the walkie-talkies and the signal corps can use the Indian languages and the enemy can't break it. They just don't know those languages.
Are there many of their young men who voluntarily go into the service, who seek the service as a career?
Oh, I don't doubt it, but I don't know it.
Mm-hmm.
I think for the most part they do their period of service and then come home.
Mm-hmm. Now, we were talking at the beginning of the program about an educational problem. Haven't there been opportunities for Indians to receive a good education? I mean, on the reservation and then further on.
Yes, and as I say, increasingly. Several of the churches have very good scholarship programs. The Save the Children Federation has been helpful in providing clothes so that small children can go to school even if their parents can't provide decent clothing for them. There's this workshop that I was mentioning that has a program for college-age students in the summertime, sort of a summer school. Various tribes have recently set aside income to provide for education. Jicarilla Apache in New Mexico have $1 million fund for scholarships.
This is for higher education?
Yes, for college.
For college education.
College. All up through high school, of course, is free, public school, either federal school on the reservation or more and more now, public schools adjacent to the reservation.
Well, the teachers who are teaching on the reservation schools, they're government paid.
Yes.
And are they not paid even higher because of their service in the government?
If the school is remote from cities and shopping centers, it's called a hardship post, and they get a certain bonus. In the school system, yes.
How well equipped are these schools?
Some of the new ones are beautiful schools. People criticize them for being too expensive. They are some very fine plants. For the most part, these are now public schools, however. They are built with federal money on or near reservations and then turned over to the public school system of the states. If they are on the reservation, the money for the maintenance of the schools will be provided by Johnson O'Malley, federal funds that pay the local school board for educating Indian children because there isn't the tax on the land to provide the base for the support of the schools.
I'm sorry, Jim.
I was going to say, isn't this perhaps a good thing? Because it seemed to me as you were talking that the Indians' educational problem then might be one of that's common throughout the country, that of integration. That is to get them out and see how the other part of the world lives, and the only way you can do that is to integrate them with other students.
But if they're reservation schools, then they are populated by all Indian children, are they not?
Yeah, that's just the problem. There's a dilemma there.
Yes.
The Bureau of Indian Affairs says we will not build any more federal schools on Indian reservations because they are, ipso facto, segregated schools. Indians look at this segregation matter differently than Negroes do, for instance. Indians frequently prefer to have their own thing for themselves and not to have the competition with white people, particularly when they're getting started. The children start not knowing English, and they're so snowed under by competition with white children who are so much farther ahead that they feel they need a special school for their particular needs. And these schools are for such little kids. For first graders to be going to a boarding school 200 miles from home is something I don't favor. I'd rather have them wait until they're 12 or so before they go up to boarding school way far from home.
Well, then, of course, the language problem, Joe, is one of the reasons, then, for the educational
problem.
Yeah. Entirely. And the fact, this was the thing that kept puzzling me, and I'm back to it again. if the government is planning an educational program for them, then why would their standard be so low, and why would it be difficult for them to compete and get into college? But now I understand it just a little bit more, because they have this language problem to overcome in the very beginning.
And yes, that's very serious, and it takes a heritage of the desire for education.
And very difficult for a teacher going in there, too, to cope with this.
Yes.
Are there cultural traits that hold the Indian down?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, this matter of not saving, being improvident. Now, they live out the precepts that we say we live by. In the fifth and sixth chapter of Matthew, we talk about not being concerned for the morrow and give to him who asks and all that sort of thing. The Indian does it and is broke. And we don't do it and save it up in the bank. There are very strong family ties that if one member of a family has a job, well, then all his cousins and aunts and uncles move in on him and it snows him down. He just can't make a go of it in our culture. He can make a go of it in his culture, but it's very difficult to live in both, and they're having a hard time.
From the very few Indians that I've ever come across, and they have been southwestern Indians, I noticed that the elders of the tribe seem to keep the children quite aware of their heritage, who they are, and their language. Is this a problem in education? I mean, say, teaching English in a reservation school, is this made more difficult because the family will steep the child when it's home about their own language? A reluctance to join the pale face, perhaps.
Well, yes, you certainly learn less rapidly if you have to learn two languages, I would think.
Does the family at home show any interest in the language the child is learning in the school? Does the family encourage the child?
That's one of the reasons I wish the school was near the reservation. Then the child goes home frequently, maybe every day preferably, and lets his parents know something about what he has learned.
Does the child who's 200 miles away and who comes home occasionally eventually outgrow his family? Or are the traditions of the family and the tribe so much a part of him that this never happens?
No, I think the history has been largely that they outgrow or move away from the old traditions. So many of these old traditions are matters of their legends, their beliefs, their medical practices are part of their religion. And the child learns new ways in the American school, so that I'm sure the active life of the Indian tradition will suffer and weaken by the children becoming educated.
Well, there's some very brilliant young men and women, though, who are at present time are actively engaged in national affairs from among the Indian people, are there not?
Well, I wish I could say that I could name a lot of them. I see a few, some very fine people, working either as tribal officers or in some of the organizations like the National Congress of American Indians.
There's a very wonderful young lawyer, is there not, there? And a young woman who has become quite internationally known because of her interest in international affairs. Of course, I know with the million that we have, one or two to name,
million,
but nevertheless,
yes.
This is encouraging.
Yes, but there ought to be a whole lot more.
There should be, of course, but the very
most
fact
of our
that
minority groups have lawyers and have professional people and publicists.
They cannot point to any professional people of note in number.
Very, very few.
Not in number.
That's all too true.
Well, of course, Maggie, I think the one thing that we haven't brought up in this program is Dr. Hetzel, being from the faculty of Haverford College,
and
how
an
did an engineer ever get mixed up with the American Indian?
Well, the Quakers have been interested in Indians for a long time, and I've been on the work camp committee of the American Friends Service Committee, and those work camps are frequently in Indian communities. And at Haverford, we had a graduate curriculum in social and technical assistance, of which I was director for a couple of years, and the field project for that program was on the North Carolina reservation of the Cherokee Indians. And then my son went and taught in an Indian school, and so since 1952, my wife and I, and sometimes the family, have been chasing Indians out in the West, mostly.
Are there many colleges that make scholarships available for the Indians?
Yes, there are quite a few, and the Bureau of Indian Affairs publishes a booklet that gives that information. They do have scholarship opportunities.
Well, that should be helpful, I think.
And I understand that you have been working with some of the youngsters at Haverford on this problem, too, even though they're studying a curriculum of general world affairs.
This graduate curriculum, yes, and in the economics department, there's a course for the economics of underdeveloped areas, and there is considerable interest on the part of the faculty and others in the Haverford community for this sort of thing.
Joe, I wonder just how close to Philadelphia could we find any Indians? Doctor,
oh dear.
Could you tell us that?
Well, up in New York State, well, here in Pennsylvania, the Corn Planter Reservation up on the Allegheny River, and then a little bit north of there, the Allegheny Reservation of the Seneca Indians. And that's a thing I'd like to mention, because just on the Allegheny River below there is Kinzua, where the proposal is to build a $100 million dam to prevent floods of Warren and Pittsburgh. Now, these Indians have a treaty with the United States that says that they will never be disturbed in the enjoyment and use of those lands. And it seems to me that when the sovereign nation has promised that not to take these lands, it has given up the right of eminent domain. So that ordinarily the nation may have the right to take land, but in this instance it said it won't. I think if it's going to be honorable, it must find some basis of agreement with the Indians to make them satisfied and not take it simply by confiscation or by condemnation, I should say.
Well, perhaps we may be fighting the Indian wars all over again, but Maggie, because of time, I'm afraid that rest of this will just have to go on. Dr. Hetzel, thank you very much for joining us this evening and giving us so much information on a subject that should be of general concern to everyone. We're delighted to know that Philadelphia has so able and so distinguished a member of the Council on Indian Affairs.
This has been the 23rd program in the Philadelphia Spotlight Series on WCAU and WCAU-FM, Philadelphia.
Hi, this is Bob Brueger with Town Talks, broadcast as usual from Strawbridge and Clothier, the Valley View restaurant here in Jenkintown at the crossroads of suburban Philadelphia. If we did the program about 7 o'clock in the evening, I'd sound all right. I don't know what happens with this cold, but it's at its worst just at noontime, and I hope by another day why I'll be over this and we'll sound like normal here again. We are today, I think more than ever, concerned with what the rest of the world thinks about us as the leaders of the free people of the world. We are very concerned about the impression that we are making in every corner of the world. And yet we have something that is kind of shameful, I think, in our own backyard. If you watch television, I'm sure the only time you hear any reference to the American Indian is on a Western where one or another of a cowboy is in pursuit of the Indian. Actually, the Indians are very much Americans. They were here 25,000 years ago, at least we think they were. Today there are approximately 500,000 Indians living in the United States. They live in substandard environment conditions, and we're going to talk about that for a few moments today. I would like you to meet an engineering teacher from Haverford College who spends his summers and a great deal of his volunteer time with the Indian Rights Association, Mr. Theodore Hetzel. Ted, it's nice having you here.
I'm glad to have this opportunity to speak to you about Indians and my interest in Indians and to tell you something about the Indian Rights Association, which is the oldest organization in the country interested in Indians, has been active in following legislation and watching legislation, giving testimony in Washington regarding Indian affairs, in disseminating information to the public at large about Indians, and visiting Indians in the field, and getting acquainted with them and their problems, and perhaps sometimes being able to help with a little cross-fertilization of ideas from one Indian group to another to help them in their social problems.
Ted, number one, what is the Indian Rights Association?
Well, it's an organization of non-denominational in character. People who are fairly well-informed and interested in Indian affairs serve on the board, and our membership is subscribing $5 a year. You can look them up in the phone book for the address in Philadelphia. Support the work of the organization and provide for the employment of a full-time general secretary who works with other organizations interested in Indian affairs and watches legislation.
Do you try to affect legislation?
No, we're not a lobbying organization, but we do follow the legislation and give testimony when opportunity presents itself by keeping informed. And I would say that we're highly respected by legislators, and our testimony is quite welcome.
There are approximately 500,000 Indians in this country. Is that correct?
That's
where are most of these Indians, and how do they live?
Of course, there used to be a lot around here.
Actually, about a quarter of them are still east of the Mississippi River, and they're in practically every state in the Union. We have a little reservation up here in Pennsylvania, the Corn Planter Reservation, which I hope we won't flood in violation of the Treaty of 1794, but looks as though maybe we will in spite of it. There are about a quarter of the Indians are in the Northwest and in the Plains, and about a quarter of them are in Oklahoma, and the remaining quarter, or perhaps more than a quarter, actually, are in the Southwest, with the greatest concentration in Arizona and New Mexico. There are maybe 200 reservations, perhaps, 200 tribes, I should say. I don't know how many Indian communities there are altogether, and maybe 150 different languages spoken. It's a very diverse group, so anything that you say is not generally applicable, but just to speak briefly, we'll have to make some generalizations in a conversation like this. So we can speak of there being an Indian problem, which is a human relations problem, a social problem, of their health, education, welfare, our relationships with them. Health is very bad. Their life expectancy is about 39, which compared to our 70-some. One tribe, the Papagos, the life expectancy is about 19 years, which is worse than most unhealthy parts of the world in underdeveloped areas.
All of this right within the border limits of the United States.
That's correct. It's an unfortunate situation that could be remedied. That's an area that's quite healthy. People go down to southern Arizona for their health. It's a health resort. But the sanitation, the water supply, and other services available to them are insufficient to provide for good health.
How about the stories we hear, Ted, about the Indians with the great big Cadillacs and the oil wells?
Well, that's terrifically exaggerated. Undoubtedly, there was enough truth in it to get the story started. In Oklahoma, the Osage Indians did have the subsurface rights to land, which the white people let them have because they thought it wasn't worth anything, but it turned out that it was worth something. There's a lot of oil there, and so the Indians got the royalties from that oil. But the productivity of the fields is decreasing, and the inheritance has fractionated the shares, and so individuals now don't get very much. There are some tribes that have large collective resources, like the Klamath Indians have very valuable forest resources, but there are enough of them so when it's all divided up. And the Navajo also are getting large incomes now, but there are about 80,000 Navajos, so by the time you divide it by 80,000, you may only have a couple thousand per person. But generally speaking, that's the total resources, not annual income. But generally speaking, the average income for Indians is about $1,000 a family. Now, families are relatively large, so that doesn't compare very favorably with the American average, which comes to something like $2,000 a person annual income. Indians are definitely underprivileged in health, education, welfare, and all the social privileges that this great country makes available to most of us.
Terrifying. When you say Indian, I think we should say American Indian each and every time. Somebody might think we're talking about the people of India. These are Americans living here. By what right can we discriminate against these people?
Well, I don't know we have a right to discriminate against anybody. Certainly, I think one of the chief troubles is that we decide that we have, well, maybe it goes back to the divine right of conquest, that we are the great people, and for some reason we have the right to decide what other people ought to want and what we ought to do to them and what we ought to do for them. The great, I would say, the chief trouble with the whole Indian situation is that we, having pushed them around and put them onto inadequate resources so they can't support themselves, and now take it upon ourselves to control their practically every action, and anything that's done in their behalf we do for them and to them and on them without asking them whether they like it or not. We don't ask them if they want a school built or where they want the school built or what they want built in the taught in the school. We simply decide they ought to have a school, we build it, and we run it the way we see fit without concerning asking them at all. And so in political decisions too, the government, well-meaning and thinking they're doing the right thing for the Indians, decides what we think would be good for them, and they aren't given the opportunity to grow up politically and assume responsibility because they don't have the opportunity to make, don't permit them to make their own decisions. So they are frustrated and don't learn to make their decisions and have not attained a modern organization of that's viable, that represents them. They are frustrated and thwarted so that they aren't making the advances that any self-respecting group ought to be permitted to make.
There must be a change within the Indian life itself and their point of view. This has been going on for a long time now here. How about the younger members of these tribes? I'm sure that many of them want to get out, want to get away, want to mingle and live in other parts of the United States. Are they permitted to do this?
Yes, they certainly are permitted. The reservations are not concentration camps. These people aren't imprisoned there. That was true at one time. The Army did round them up and limit them, keep them on the reservation. But Individuals are free to come and go. In fact, the government is very helpful in its relocation program in making it possible for those who do want to move to the big cities and enter into Americans' stream of life to do so. But to force people to do that, I think, is not the correct solution to the Indian problem. In fact, the Indian population is increasing so rapidly that even though a great many do leave, there enough remains so that the communities are still will still exist. In fact, I think it can be said that the Indian communities will exist indefinitely as far as we can see. The Indians are not dying out either as numerically or as a cultural groups, as tribes. There seems to be considerable effort on the part of the government to minimize the tribal existence, speaking as though that's sort of a communistic, un-American sort of political organization. But I think if we think of a tribe as being a corporation or a county or a group of people working in their own behalf, it's entirely in keeping with the American tradition.
One way or another, we have to support this, don't we? We either support it through unemployment and compensations, and it's a black mark against us, or we try to do something positive about it.
That's correct. It does cost us about $100 million a year to run the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and it seems to be going up rather than down. I might say, however, many people think that many benefits accrue to Indians just because they are Indians, but actually it has been demonstrated that Americans, by and large, get about $200 worth of services a year from the federal government, whereas Indians get not much over $100 a year benefits from the federal government, so that they are not a privileged group compared to the rest of us.
What I want to know, Ted, is this is something I think that concerns a great many Americans. I think there's a genuine interest in this right now. How could one find out more about your work and perhaps join the Indian Rights Association?
Well, thanks for the opportunity to put in a plug, because all you do is look up in the phone book, the Indian Rights Association on 1505 Ray Street, and write for information, hopefully send a check to support the work, because that's what it really takes is the wherewithal to keep people busy and in the field and cover the expenses of these operations.
My congratulations to you and to the other men working with you in Indian Rights. We did a program about this about a year and a half or 2 years ago, and we had so many calls and so much interest in it that I hope we do the same again. It's the Indian Rights Association. You can find it in your telephone directory, an organization doing a continuing fine job. However, we've just begun to scratch the surface, and this is something that I think we might be ashamed of, what's happening to a group within our own country. We are the ones that moved in on them. They were here a long, long time ago, and perhaps we haven't done as much for them as we might have. The Indian Rights Association, our guest has been Mr. Theodore Hetzel. Thanks, Ted. We would like to do something real fast now. We would like to swing round table and have you meet members of the White Marsh Valley Optimist Club. This is throughout the Optimist Clubs in the United States. This is Youth Appreciation Week. And we would like you to meet three of the members of the White Marsh Club who are come here today to talk something about Youth Appreciation Week. First, we would like you to meet the Secretary Treasurer of the club, and he is Mr. George Gibbs. Hi, George.
Hi, Bob.
George, what is Youth Appreciation Week?
Youth Appreciation Week is a week set aside each year by the Optimist Clubs of North America to recognize the good in the youth of today. We have found, statistically, that only 5% of our youth come in direct contact with the law. And basically, all we want to do is give a pat on the back to those 95% who we feel will be the citizens of tomorrow.
And the president of the Optimist Club at White Marsh Valley, Mr. Harold Saunders. Hi, Hal.
Hi, Bob.
Hal, how did this get started with Optimist Clubs?
About 5 years ago, the Optimist chapter in Charlotte, North Carolina, became very much disturbed about the adverse publicity of the modern youth today, which was being brought upon them by the activities of, say, 5%. They wanted to highlight the youth of today, that the 95% that definitely were not getting into any kind of major conflict with the law. So they went to Governor Hodges of North Carolina, presented this idea to him. He thought it was an excellent idea and heartily endorsed it. It proved to be such a success in North Carolina that the Optimist International adopted it, and in 1957, which was the first year that it was tried, over 700,000 youths participated in youth appreciation activities. Last year, which was our second year, 1958, over 17 million youngsters in the United States participated in Youth Appreciation Week. And this year, we expect it to be even larger than last year.
Do you have special activities down here, Hal, during this week?
Yes, we do. Our group was just organized, so we have not been able to have any special activities ourselves, other than, say, being guests on your program here, Bob, and to highlight to the community that this is Youth Appreciation Week. But throughout the country, the Optimist International does have prepared programs from activities, presenting certificates for outstanding citizenship, dances, parades, and various types of community activities along that line to highlight to the community that 95% of our youngsters are going to grow up to be good citizens and our greatest asset to our community.
I remember a story not too long ago in one of the magazines, Reader's Digest or something, a 12-year-old boy on his 13th birthday, and his father asked him how he felt about being a teenager, and he said it was very fine, except for the reputation. We would like you to meet now the vice president of the White Marsh Valley Optimist Club and chairman of Youth Appreciation Week for that club, Mr. John Alliger. Hi, John.
Hi, Bob. I know the question is often asked, well, why concentrate on youth that are doing so well? How about the youth that are getting in trouble? And it's our feeling, frankly, that if we spent more time in youth appreciation rather than the condemnation of the very few that get into trouble, which is, of course, less than 5%, we feel that juvenile delinquency might even reduce itself. We know that condemnation gets much better results, or rather we know that praise gets much better results than condemnation, and we want the community to recognize these young people and to give them the praise that I think they surely deserve, and that's the whole purpose of our program. Thanks, Bob.
You boys are taking time out from jobs. I better tell them where you're from. Hal Saunders is with the Container Corporation of America, I believe. George Gibbs is with the Bell Telephone Office here in Jenkintown. And John Alliger is with an investment. What's the name of that investment firm?
King Merritt and Company in Jenkintown.
Right. And they're all members of the White Marsh Valley Optimist Club here, telling you something about Youth Appreciation Week. Our first guest was Mr. Ted Hetzel with the Indian Rights Association. We're broadcasting from the Valley View Restaurant at Strawbridge and Clothier, famous stove for menus, a delightful place for lunch or dinner. We'll be back tomorrow at 12:15.
This is your good music station.
Dr. Theodore B. Hetzel. Let's welcome Dr. Hetzel, Associate Professor of Engineering at Haverford College.
Thanks, Frank.
Doctor, it's nice to have you here. Thank you for coming. You're a member of the Board of Indian Rights Association. I would suppose that we discuss minority problems in this program as much as any other subject, but very few people ever think about the Indians as a minority. We look upon them as the guys that appear on television, you know, and fighting the cowboys, and they're the bad guys generally. But it's kind of a... to talk about Indians, people say, well, are there Indians?
Sure are. About 500,000 of them in the country.
Do they have a vote?
Sure they vote. Since 1924, they're all citizens. Not that they all vote, because they may live too far from a voting place, and maybe there's too difficult to get registered and all that, but they have the privilege.
Well, they don't. All the 500,000 are kind of spread around the country, though.
Very much so. About something less than a quarter of them, perhaps, are east of the Mississippi River, where they previously lived. About a quarter of them, did I say a quarter east of the Mississippi,
mm-hmm.
about, and about a quarter
mm-hmm.
in the northwest, and about a quarter in this central, centering around Oklahoma, and perhaps more than a quarter in the southwest, with the greatest concentration in Arizona and New Mexico.
Well, why is it, Dr. Hetzel, since these are the original settlers, and I'm always kind of tickled at the DAR, because they are so uppity about their ancestors. I always think of what the great humorist Will Rogers said, who was at a party one time. This probably is an old story to you.
He said lots of good stories.
Yeah, well, Will Rogers is at a party one time, and one of the Snooty Society people got talking about her ancestors and said, my ancestors came over in the Mayflower. And Will Rogers, who, of course, was part Indian, said, yeah, and my kinfolk were here to welcome them, and they came.
Yeah.
Well, I think the big problem here is that there's so few Indians compared to the 175 million of the rest of us that people don't much give a hang, do they?
Yeah, there's some truth in that. There's also an old saying that... too many chiefs and too few Indians. That seemed to be the typical thing of the past. Unfortunately, now I might turn it around the other way and say that there are too few chiefs and too many Indians, because the life expectancy of the Indian is so low, not like the problem we heard Mr. Robinson a moment ago.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have any problem of geriatrics among the Indians. The average life expectancy is 39 for American Indians. And for Papago Indians, down in the very healthful and salubrious climate of southern Arizona, the life expectancy is 19 years of age.
What's killing them off?
Well, so most of the Indians are children, and therefore there aren't enough mature, productive workers to support all the dependents. Most of the Indians are dependents. Well, what's killing them off? Mostly the unhealthy water supply and sanitation, primarily. There's been many efforts made to pass laws to promote sanitation on Indian reservations, but it's been blocked by one congressman for many years, and just this year has it been passed. So we're about to go to town, I hope, in some better sanitation for Indians.
Which congressman is that?
Miller. Know the name?
Yeah, where's he from?
Nebraska.
Why? What does Mr. Miller have against Indians? Did some of them kill his grandfather or something?
No. I almost wanted to say, in fact, I'll say now, in line with what you were mentioning a while ago about welcoming the people from the Mayflower, Some of my ancestors arrived over here in 1683, and they wouldn't have survived the first winter if it hadn't been for the Indians who helped them with some food.
Mm-hmm.
Why, what Miller had against the Indians having sanitary facilities provided for them, I guess there's something that can be said in his behalf, because many communities are mixed. They're not all 100% Indian, and he figured that the American way of doing things wasn't to provide services for people that he felt they ought to supply for themselves. But I can add quickly that most of these Indian communities, and I've seen a great many of them, they simply don't have the wherewithal to provide the kinds of facilities that we think Americans ought to have.
Well, let's talk a little bit about, are all the Indians in this country, you mentioned about a half a million, are they all pretty much alike except for certain tribal customs?
Well, we'll have to lump them all together, I guess, in a short conversation like this, but they certainly vary very greatly. We'll have to make some generalities,
mm-hmm.
but they're all kinds. Those who lived in the woods and those who lived in villages in the pueblos of the southwest along the Rio Grande, there are Indians who had matriarchal arrangements. Some had patriarchal, and some were warlike, and I might say that most are very pacifistic. Contrary to the TV picture that one sees, Indians generally were rather peace-loving, except for the Sioux, who have set a pattern that the TV has publicized.
Mm-hmm. Why, take those Sioux away, and there'd be 4,000 writers and Hollywood actors would starve to death, be nothing to write about.
Uh-huh.
Well, today, Dr. Hetzel, what do they do for a living?
Well, that's a good question. They do all sorts of things, of course. Many have left the reservations and are working in the cities. The Bureau of Indian Affairs has been very helpful in assisting them with transportation and getting established in the cities and vocational training to learn jobs. Way back there, a few generations ago, the government was trying to make farmers out of the Indians, and that didn't work very well in most instances. It did work in some, but with most of the Indians, farming was woman's work, and that was a degradation to a man to be a farmer. He was a hunter or warrior, but not to be a farmer.
But didn't the word get back to the Indians that today the farmers are being paid not to produce? Didn't anybody tell them?
Well, unfortunately, that doesn't seem to work. They figure, it seems, that if anybody's going to produce surpluses, let it be white people, and let's not have any Indians producing any surpluses. So that was unpopular politically.
Well, why do so many of them seem, and from what I've read, and this isn't very much, actually, why do so many of them seem to return to the reservation?
Well, that's a good question.
They go out to school, and they get education, and they seem to go back again.
Yeah. Well, they have a different set of values than they find in our civilization. They have very, very close family ties. In fact, that is to their advantage in this problem of the old folks, because the old folks have a welcome at home. They know that there's something for them to do. There's never any problem of will they be outcasts in their own society. Family ties are very close, and they just love to be with each other. And the idea of working real hard and saving money and looking forward to the rainy day, they say a white man's always getting ready to live. Indian, he live all the time. They just enjoy...
But he don't live long, from what you tell me.
No, unfortunately. But while they're living, they enjoy it every minute. And they just love to be with their people and let tomorrow take care of itself, which is part of our tradition, too, biblically. But we don't seem to work that way. We'd rather have it in the bank.
Well, either that or we charge it or open a credit account someplace.
Well,
haven't they gotten wind of that with those smoke signals yet?
They can't do that because, you see, they live on trust land that's tax-free, and what bank's going to lend any money to an Indian whose land he can't mortgage? So the Indian can't borrow money to go into business or do his farming. The only person he can borrow from is Uncle Sam, and Uncle Sam hasn't been a very good lender. There was quite a fund, a revolving loan fund, which... the money was there, but the Bureau wouldn't lend it for quite a long time until a bunch of organizations
security.
Like the Indian Rights Association and others who keep looking over the Bureau's shoulder to see if they're doing the right thing start howling about it, and now they've loosened up, and so some of the tribes are getting money lent to them that's getting them started in some enterprise. Unfortunately, though, the Indians are living on land that we didn't want particularly, and we pushed them back into the poorest land that we weren't too much interested in, and left them too little land, so that and it's pretty far from markets, and it's 80% of it has less than 20 inches of rain a year, so it's dry farm, dry at the best. Only 6% of all the Indian land is arable farmland. So as Will Rogers again said, the Indian was guaranteed the right to keep and use his land as long as the sun should shine and the grass should grow and the waters run, but they only gave the Indian the land where no grass would grow and where no rain did fall. So,
mm-hmm. Well, some people feel that every Indian who lives in the Southwest, like in Oklahoma or someplace, is oil rich.
Well, there was a little truth to that. Got enough truth to get the idea started. The Osage Indians lived on some land that nobody, the white people, didn't think was any good. And they found some oil there. And the Indians owned it corporately as a tribe. That is, they owned the subsurface rights, so that any royalties from the oil did come to the Indians, and they had head rights. But there weren't very many of them. I wouldn't know just how many. It might be 1,000 Indians, Osage Indians at the most, and those fields aren't very productive anymore, so that the head rights for those few Indians don't amount to too much. The Klamath Indians have a very fine stand of timber, which collectively is worth quite a bit. It's been in the papers recently because of the termination. The federal government is going to cut loose from them and not have the trustee supervision over their land and management of their affairs. But when you divide it by the number of Klamath Indians, it doesn't really amount to much. It's a nice little sum, maybe $20,000 a person. But that's capital, that's not income.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess they're about the wealthiest in the country.
I want to talk about a situation in New York, Dr. Hetzel, in just a minute. The New York papers have been full of a big problem in upper New York State concerning the Seneca Indians and lands which they own by treaty with the United States. Lands which I read are being taken away from them for a big water conservation program in upper New York State, and I'll get to that in a minute. Our guest, ladies and gentlemen, is Dr. Theodore B. Hetzel. Dr. Hetzel is an associate professor of engineering at Haverford College. And you say, what does he know about Indians? Well, he's a member of the Board of Indian Rights Association. He is also chairman of the Indian Program Committee of the American Friends Service Committee. And something just struck me. For three nights in a row now, we have had a representative from the American Friends Service Committee. And each time on a different subject. One was for Tunisian orphans and mothers who are quickly starving to death. Another night we talked with somebody from the American Friends Service Committee on a completely different subject, and now about Indians. It occurs to me the American Friends Service Committee has a lot of irons in the fire. You have a wide range of interests.
Very true. Very true.
I think this is to your credit. I'm not saying this in any way to say, why don't you stop it? I'm saying, to me, it's a wonderful thing that people take interest in other people. We'll return with our guest in just a moment. The Senecas hold title to a large piece of very valuable land, and that the state of New York wants to take this land because they say they need it for water conservation. Is that true?
Yes, that's true. I don't know how valuable the land is in white men's terms. It's not so terrifically huge. It has the very peculiar boundaries of being 1/2 mile on either side of the river, which is a rather difficult thing to survey, I would think.
Mm-hmm.
It's extremely valuable to those Indians, but and unfortunately, if this dam is built in Pennsylvania at Kinsua, it will flood that land almost completely, certainly all the useful part of it. It would just leave the hilltops and the steep hillsides. It's a very steep valley, which couldn't really be used for anything except a cabin for a hunting party. The situation, I was very much interested. You had a telephone call on this subject a couple nights ago, too.
That's right.
And I would agree very much with what was said then. One thing I would want to add is that...
Well, let me just say this. The caller had suggested that since the Senecas are a nation within a nation in this country, and since they can't get any satisfaction from the federal government, the telephone caller said, why don't they take their problems to the United Nations, since the Senecas are a nation? Mm-hmm. I didn't know the answer because, I just didn't know it.
Well, I don't agree with them on that. I know some of them think that way. I would say that they're Americans, citizens of our country. They do have a treaty with the United States in 1794 that guarantees them the continuous use of their land as long as they wish to occupy it.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say that an instance like that, where the sovereign nation has made a treaty saying that it will not exercise the right of eminent domain, that even the sovereign nation no longer has that right in this instance. Now, I also believe in the greatest good for the greatest number, and I believe in soil conservation and water resources control, and I think it's very important to prevent these floods in Warren and down the Allegheny River in Pittsburgh. And it's very important to industry to have good, clear, fresh water continuously throughout the year, which this project would help assure them.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say that it's an instance where an agreement has to be reached. You have to make a deal with these Indians that be satisfactory to them. And the thing that no white people have ever suggested would be that let's let the Indians have some other land which would be tax-free, or let's buy some other land for them. Now, just this summer, we're out in the Dakotas, and the dams on the Missouri River have flooded a lot of Indian land. And the Indians were well paid for that land, but they were well paid at a time, or that is, the price was established at one time, and they get paid a year or two later. government moves rather slowly in these things, and by the time a little inflation comes along, and then by the time they take that money and go off the reservation, adjacent to the reservation, and try to buy some land, they find that the other land has gone up 3-4 times the price that it was before. So that the supposedly honest price that they received for the land that they lost isn't adequate to buy anything like equivalent land elsewhere. Now, if the government would buy up some equivalent land that would be satisfactory to these Indians, of course, this is anathema. This would take this would be political dynamite to buy out some white people and say, you're the guys that got to move. But I would say that these Indians have a treaty that says that they will not be disturbed. And by golly, I think in our own integrity and international reputation, we have to deal honorably with these people, just like we have to deal honorably with the other people in other nations in the world. I don't mean to say other nations. These are Seneca Nation by name, but they are Americans. But we must deal honorably according to our treaties.
But they don't have many votes, do they?
Unfortunately, that isn't a political, not politically powerful, no. They have more than 1,000, but that doesn't swing a great deal. But it's the moral issue of we have guaranteed not to disturb them, and I would say that we must come to some agreement with them, which might be expensive, to buy some other land and perhaps set up a fund which, when amortized, would pay the annual taxes, or some arrangement be made. These Indians have been guaranteed the tax-free rights to their land. Now, that would be very nice. I guess everybody in this room would like to have a treaty with the United States government not to have to pay any taxes on land.
Not if I had to be an Indian to do it, though.
Well, something to that. But they have the just the same right that a church has to tax-free status of its land, or people who own tax-free bonds. They would set up an awful howl if the government said tomorrow, all holders of tax-free bonds pay tax henceforth. Or if veterans didn't have the privileges that the that laws have provided for them. There are many people that are privileged. Blind people are privileged. They don't have to pay as much income tax. These Indians have been pushed off of the lands that they had originally onto, as I said, inadequate land, unproductive land, not enough land, and it's they have it coming to them to have this slightly privileged situation of tax-free land.
Doctor, we have an interruption here for a newscast. We'll keep you just for a few more minutes after the news, if you don't mind. I have a few more questions to ask. We'd also like to say hello to Celia Saint, who is here in the room. Miss Saint is singing at the Celebrity Room. We'll have her as a guest a little bit later on, too. Stay tuned now to WPEN, AM and FM in Philadelphia. Back in 5 minutes. Now, Bill Smith and the news. This is Theodore B. Hetzel. Dr. Hetzel is Associate Professor of Engineering at Haverford College. Doctor, you mentioned that you're a member, or I mentioned you're a member of the Board of Indian Rights Association. What is that organization?
Well, it's the oldest of the Indian interest organizations, founded 77 years ago here in Philadelphia. A couple of young men were invited to visit some Episcopalian missions in the Dakotas, and after they came, what they saw out there led them to believe that the Indians were much abused and in need of some defense in Washington and elsewhere before the public. So this organization has been operating ever since. We have an office here in Philadelphia on 1505 Race Street, full-time executive secretary and secretarial help. He maintains a contact with Indians and with other Indian interest organizations and with legislation, provides information to our members, more than 1,000 members who receive the publications of the Indian Rights Association, go to Washington, various board members or our executive secretary go to Washington to testify hearings before congressional committees in matters regarding Indian legislation. So it's educational and field work in consultation with Indian tribes and in Washington with legislation.
Does the Bureau of Indian Affairs, in your opinion, do much of a job of doing anything for the Indians?
Yes, they certainly do. But my comment there would be that they do things for the Indians. And that's the way they're set up. By legislation, they are supposed to render service to Indians. But that, I would say, was a fundamental mistake. And unfortunately, I guess Congress is not educated to the new approach, which I would say was comparable to the Point 4 approach in dealing with people in other countries. And I feel that we need to develop that relationship with other people, a respect for them and their values and their personalities. If we consider liberty and freedom are chief values of our American civilization, I think we can only say that they are based on a respect for individuals. And when we deal with internationally with other peoples, if we make up our minds what's good for them and go do it to them, they don't appreciate it too much. And the same way with the Indians. It's been decided in Washington what's good for Indians, and then we go out there and do it to them.
do it to them, huh?
Yeah. They aren't asked whether they want a school built in a certain place or a highway built. They're not asked what should be taught in this school. Or if they are, if they do say, nobody listens to them. With very well-meaning and with a lot of money spent, $100 million a year, we sort of take care of the Indians. Mm-hmm. And that precludes them from growing up in maturity. We call it paternalism.
Mm-hmm.
We don't let them grow up to assume responsibility for their own affairs. They